Hello, I'm Scott Winstead, FMI Consulting President. I'm really excited to share my conversation with Bob Euler with you. Bob is the former CEO and chairman of MWH Global, a post that he held for 12 years inside of his 36-year career within the firm. During his tenure, Bob led the transformation of the MWH business platform from one country to 36 and from $100 million in revenue to over $1.6 billion in revenue. Through a combination of organic geographic and client expansion strategies and the integration of over 20 acquisitions, by the time he retired, MWH was ranked as the global market share leader in global wet infrastructure services by U.S. and international industry journals and the 12th largest E&R design firm in the world. Through it all, MWH was a unique, global, pure-play water environmental infrastructure firm dedicated to a singular sector. Bob holds an undergraduate degree in engineering from the United States Military Academy at West Point, where he was also a varsity athlete. He holds a graduate degree in engineering from the University of Florida and an advanced management program certificate from Harvard Business School. Following his time at West Point, Bob served his country as an Airborne Ranger Combat Commander with decorated distinction of 2 bronze medals and 4 combat air medals for valor in Vietnam with the 101st Airborne Division. I've been looking forward to this conversation since we first started talking about it a number of months ago. Every time we've had the opportunity to connect over the years, I've always left the conversations with a number of helpful frameworks or mental models that I've managed to incorporate into our work with clients and within our own firm, which is why I'm so excited to share this conversation with our audience. Bob, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here, as always, and thank you so much for your military service.
Thank you, Scott, and I appreciate that kind introduction.
Well, I'd love to start off, if you would, Bob, just with a quick thumbnail of what you're up to these days professionally.
Today, I work on several boards, both nonprofit and profit, and I also do some mentoring for CEOs, usually more experienced, older CEOs who are thinking about succession or retirement, who really don't have anyone to talk to, essentially, and pretty busy, but also have some free time.
That's great. You definitely earned the free time, for sure. I'd love for you to kind of share your take on what's the role of the CEO today and how maybe that's evolved over time in your eyes.
Yeah, well, I think the CEO role is still the same as it's been. You know, the CEO's job is to define a future vision and then to get a strategy and implementation plan to make it happen. Hardly anything happens in the long run without the CEO's advocacy and actually ownership. So I think the only difference is that today I feel things are moving a bit faster because of digital world around us and also starting to get involved with the digital space interruption of value chains in the personnel business.
That's a great point, Bob. Will you share more about your view of the disruption of value chains?
The problem we face is we have to innovate and we have to meld new capabilities in to keep the value of our services as high as competitors or higher. And that's a challenge, especially for larger companies, because they have more internal moving parts. They have to be aligned. Often when we find innovation, we find it in smaller companies that are more agile because they don't have the bureaucracy or the power structure. They might be threatened by it.
I would agree with that. And I think one of the things that we see is I think the shelf life of any differentiation is a lot shorter than it used to be, just with respect to the speed of change and how fast everything's moving, you know, Moore's Law being what it is.
Well, that's correct. I think, you know, the first mover may not be the best position because you can catch up fast. We used to always say first out, competitive advantage. Now, maybe not. Maybe we can catch up and not take the risk of the first mover.
That's a great point. Well, and historically speaking, anyway, for large swaths of the industry, you know, we've always seen that, at least on the construction side, maybe less so on the engineering and design side, that, you know, a lot of the benefits of technology and technological process and know-how can sometimes accrue to the owner and not necessarily to the contractor. I think that is a little bit different on the engineering side, but it's interesting to kind of see how that sort of shapes the value equation.
Yeah, I think there is a difference because in construction, you know, we see progressions of technology, especially in the procurement side and the modularization side of how fast and how efficient we can do it. Clients want that capital cost returned to them. On the advisory side or the consulting side, I think we have our greatest enemies are internal people who demand not to risk rate changes because it basically puts a target on them and they don't feel truly that the client will say yes. And partly because I don't think they're confident they are superior. They have a superior relationship, but maybe not a superior technology.
Well, and it certainly gets put to the test in that situation. Something you touched on a bit ago is you talked about the role of the CEO and his or her responsibility to cast a vision and to align the business around that vision. Something that I've heard from you and have used with a number of our clients is just this exercise that you shared with me once about sitting down with CEOs and asking them to write an article, like a Wall Street Journal article. And so just so I don't say too much, I'd love for you to, in your own words, kind of talk about how you've used that with your CEO clients and what you're trying to get them to be able to do.
Well, as I said, I think that CEOs want the job for one of two reasons. Either they want the rank and robe, the prestige of it, and they somewhat see the job as a maintenance job, maintaining the organization, maintaining its momentum. And then there are some CEOs that basically have a vision, a compelling vision that they want the company to go for. It could be more focus, it could be more geography, it could be more products, it could be more internal synergies. But in the second category, which is the one I think boards would like CEOs to do, not maintain, but transform to a higher value enterprise, I think you get there an issue of time management and your ability to focus where you put your attention. And I think that that's really one of the challenges we face with CEOs who have a line outside their door every Monday morning of new activities and issues and news, and people just wanting to be noticed rather than drive a change strategy.
And that's great. Just to kind of build off of that, you were kind enough to share some remarks at a CEO conference we hosted a number of years ago after receiving an award, and you talked about the four levels of leadership and how CEOs often do spend their time versus how they maybe should spend their time.
When we talk to CEOs, we have to put it in terminology that they can handle rather than the fluffy, you're just not doing enough futuristic things. So I came up with an arbitrary foundation of levels of thinking or levels of time spent. And level one is just the exchange of information, problems, issues that come to a CEO on a daily basis. It's almost the operations talking to you. And it's pretty demanding because the bigger the operation, the more time is spent in that area. I call that level one, just arbitrarily. Level two is where you basically take issues, problems, or challenges, and you sit down and try to develop a plan, a short-term plan to either avoid the problem in the future or accelerate the benefit of whatever's happening. So it's planning, it's futuristic, where level one is almost historical, level two is short-term plan. And then there's level three, which I call the intermediate zone, which is the 3 to 5 years, where hopefully a CEO having a vision, you have some initiatives that you've started to try to get you to where you need to be. And you're basically looking at these initiatives and trying to nurture them in the organization. And because they're small and because they're not particularly powerful, the CEO has to be the pusher of those initiatives. And this is what I call level three, the short-term evolution of the plan. But truthfully, we should, as CEOs, start with level four, which it to me is the enterprise and trying to create a more valuable enterprise for the shareholders and a more favorable environment for people, especially in a people business as such. So that's visionary stuff. That's you know, what should be our capital base? How many shareholders should we have and why? What geography should we play in? Should we be one, two, or three sectors? Why not? And it's the foundation of what the enterprise is going to be in the future. And this is the one that I try to get CEOs to pay attention to by asking them to write an article in the Wall Street Journal or whatever, which would describe 5 years from now their success. What was their legacy? What did they accomplish? How would they measure it? And therefore, they could articulate it. And I think it's very important to actually start from there and work backwards. And I know that this is level one, two, three, and four are you know, I could talk for a day about them. Good news is I have a colleague who worked for me for 5 or 8 years who's writing a book right now called Engineering Behavior Change, named Gary Sanderson, which should be coming out later this year, which will probably go into more detail about what we just talked about.
You'd shared that a lot of times that exercise or that assignment is harder for CEOs to do than you might think it is, to just think out 5 years and you know, starting with the end in mind, write it as if it's in the present tense, but it's 5 years out, and then you know, reverse engineer it. So it says easy, does hard, as they say.
Yeah, that's a great comment. Not easy. It's not easy to implement, and it's not easy to declare. When you declare, you actually put a target up and on yourself as to whether that's really what you can do and whether you can accomplish it. So that's declaring. That's a little risky for a CEO to declare what they think it ought to be. There'll be some people that are unhappy with that and some people that are saying, wait a minute, that changes our power structure, if that's true. And so it can cause consternation. One of the things that I find really interesting when you talk about the four levels, you can sit down with the CEO and explain this and they get it. They get it completely. They may not like it or they may like it. It doesn't matter. But one of the things they find themselves is not being able to change their time management. That the truth is that level one is demanding, comes to them. They don't have to do a thing. There's a line outside. Level two, the same way, if it's serious problems, you're in the planning phase. But nobody except the board of directors is talking to you about level four and level three. And therefore, you don't have a constant demand unless you prioritize your time to do it. And one of the ways that I try to do this with CEOs is ask them to look back. In other words, look back over a month or look back over a couple of weeks and ask yourself, what levels did I spend my time in? Where did I drive the meeting versus I was taken to the meeting? That I was an audience rather than a driver of it. And by the way, you cannot ignore level one and two either. It's just a matter of time management. And it's very challenging because it's self-discipline.
Well, that's a great point. I think it's, you know, because let's face it, most of these folks get to the level of CEO because they're world-class problem solvers, right? So when the problems find them, the natural instinct, human nature is such that you're going to jump in and solve the problem because you've solved a million of them before. There's also this philosophy around time management and delegation speaks to org design and org structure. And if you don't have the organizational structure and the leadership structure such that the CEO can delegate to, you know, his or her direct reports, then you're going to naturally you're going to have to jump in to solving problems.
Yeah, that's another area that we often talk to CEOs. We ask them about their decision matrices. And are they up to date? Are they actually exist? Or are they purely the way we run kind of thing? I actually like decision matrices to be laid out as to who's the decision maker, who's the veto, who needs to know and get and who need to get advice from to do things. And I like it current. I like it reviewed every year and a gradual evolution where more decision making is subordinated to your staff rather than rest on you. And then you have a design you can rely on and say, that's not my issue. You know, have you talked to so-and-so? You know, look at the decision matrix. But I think one of the issues we face is that, just as you said, People get to the top of these organizations because they've been really good decision makers in the past. They get a lot of kudos and benefit from making decisions and contemplating the future and trying to figure out how to get to the future is much more fluffy and difficult to spend time on and be rewarded for. I mean, it's a long-term reward, not a short-term reward.
Well, and just to build on that, again, coming from another one of your writings that I really enjoyed, as you talk about the visionary CEO versus the maintenance CEO, you know, that CEO has got to align the organization around said vision and compel people, you know, their people to do things that haven't been done before, right? If it's visionary, therefore, by definition, it hasn't been done before. And then you get into this continuum or this tug of war between, you know, two concepts, popularity as a leader versus respect as a leader. And I'd love for you to kind of share your take on that and how that can sometimes or oftentimes will affect CEOs and their relative success in the job.
Well, especially consulting firms or knowledge-based firms that have a great number of people rather than hard products. People work in organizations and they gain a reputation of being likable or unlikable. It is a little bit separate from their did I accomplish something or didn't. Sometimes it meshes beautifully and other times it doesn't. But one thing for sure is if the company's seeking an inside player, they get two things that could be a problem. One of them is they could be picking a chief operating officer who still wants to be one and wants to stay at level one and two because that's what they're used to. And the second is that they may be picking someone that's popular rather than totally effective at that role. And it shouldn't be of any oddity in terms of collegial organizations that someone unpopular, regardless of their achievements, probably isn't going to be the CEO. And so you get into this, what is the driver of the CEO's decision-making? And you find out that if a CEO is really worried about unpopular decisions, wants someone else to make them or is fearful of them, they probably are not going to be as effective as someone who says, I'm not in the job to be popular. I'm in the job to be effective and be respected. And I will be respected for what I'm trying to accomplish. I can describe it. And it may not make people happy with me, but I'm into that effect that I'm in charge of. So, I mean, it is an issue where I have found situations where CEOs ask me to consider a subordinate for a higher level. And I immediately detect that popularity is a really important issue to that person. And it'll be hard to transform it into, I don't care about popularity, I care about respect. It's a hard mid-career course to change.
Absolutely, and it's a great observation. I want to switch gears now a little bit and talk about strategy and where organizations place their bets, and specifically about how do you think about the balance between focus and diversification?
Well, for me, you know, a base consideration for an enterprise is where do you want to be on the extremes of the side of an enterprise? One of them is relatively commoditized services at low cost that are highly competitive, or highly specialized services that are a premium and they tend to be higher priced. And if you pick the middle, you sometimes become a me too. So picking one, either you're going to be Costco or you're going to be Cartier, is a pretty important decision. I lean toward the Cartier, and Cartiers require focus. They can't be numerous sectors and numerous things because they need to keep pouring attention into that one topic that they're in. While if you're dealing with the Costcos of the world, they work more on overhead costs and the efficiency of the back room and things like that. So you can only focus if you can get economic stability over economic cycles. So if you're in a highly volatile business, you probably wouldn't be wise to be in one sector. you would probably better yourself in two or three sectors to accomplish that. The beauty of my old sector was the water sector, and it hardly has a recession. You know, people will still drink water and have water to clean up and everything else. And so it allowed us that focus, quite frankly. If I'd been in transportation, I'm not sure we could have focused as much as we did. But still, even if I was in transportation, I would still want to be really good at what I did and charge for it and not be distracted by five or six different sectors.
Well, a couple of things that you said that I would just want to reemphasize. One, you know, economic stability over economic cycles. That's the key to it, right? If you're going to focus on a few or even one or two, pick the right sectors. Either strategy or philosophy can work, focus or differentiation, but just know which bed you're going to lay in and build a business model around those things.
Yeah, and I think it all has to do with your brand and eventually what the world thinks of your company. In other words, when I say Costco, you think of commodity buying and package buying at low cost is what you think of. If I say Tiffany's, you think of high-end jewelry and high-end things, and that supports your pricing too by doing that. And that's the other thing I think, that you cannot have a different price model or a value model in more than one sector without confusing the client. So you can't be a commodity player in one sector and a high priority, high tech player in another sector and get a brand that the client believes.
And just to continue on that sort of strategy theme, I want to shift gears towards the notion of geographic diversification. Would love, Bob, if you would share your philosophy around geographic diversification.
Really good point. And it has much to do with your clients and their demands and the scale of the opportunities you're trying to pursue. If you're trying to pursue mega opportunities, geographical dispersion is not terribly important, except for the marketing side, getting leads. You can be more centralized. If you're going after medium and small jobs that might lead to big jobs, then you need to be the client's friend and understand their problems better than anybody else. And doing that remotely is very difficult. But we also, you know, my previous company, MWH Global, had 140 plus offices. You really got to struggle to keep 140 plus offices profitable. You have a third that aren't profitable, a third that are profitable, and you hope the other third are so profitable they feed the others or replace the others. But geography by itself is a dispersion and a decentralization. And it's very difficult to push a common brand through 20 different people.
It's a great point. That's probably a whole separate podcast at some point. But, you know, just on the topic of geographic diversification, while we're on it, you know, having done a lot of it throughout your career, how would you break down the short list of critical ingredients?
Well, when you decentralized geographically, you actually are creating a whole bunch of mini CEOs. So I find that part of our issue of success in decentralization is to have models that allow a regional manager to affect 20 people or 10 people, who is more of a long-term, bigger thinker, while other people are doing smaller, medium-sized jobs. So organizational design, we've experimented with many of them, what hub and spoke, where you have center, which basically does a lot of the work, but the relationships are done in a geographical dispersion, but then they're all part of one. It's a hub and spoke. That's the sum, and you don't try to get profit and loss out of every one of them, the spokes, because you can't get critical mass. You can feed a center, but you can't be profitable in any given spoke.
Bob, if you're okay with it, I'd love to go back to the sector theme for just a moment and would love your take. As if you were in the CEO chair today, where would you be looking to place your bets from a sector standpoint?
Yeah, that's a great question, Scott. And I have to admit that my breadth and knowledge of all the sectors is a bit limited because I was a focuser in the water sector. But I will make just some general comments about attractiveness of sectors. Attractive sectors are sectors that are changing fast and tied to your ability to be agile. So if you find a sector that's highly affected by either demands and or technology, it's a pretty good place to be as long as you are an agile adapter to it, because you're going to have to change. And the faster you change with that sector, the more you have opportunity, because they have different problems evolving very quickly as such. So I like sectors that are growing. I don't like stagnant, commoditized sectors. I think they create real challenges of displacing personality rather than technological or organizational advantage. Over time, some sectors move faster than other sectors just due to technology as such. Like you think of the pharmaceutical sector is a very fast moving, evolving sector, where their products are expiring very quickly, or the food sector, or is that? But you get in transportation, and the technology is slow to change, and the competition is very ingrained, and the clients are very used to commoditized services. So you get a challenge there if you're not a player to enter that market and grow very fast.
That's super helpful as a framework or philosophy. If you could sum it up to just one or two things, what's the best piece of advice you've ever received?
I think the best piece of advice is to be comfortable being uncomfortable, because a CEO has to declare a future that does not necessarily exist today and convince others that is a target that has a reasonable chance of success. And so if you're uncomfortable talking about this kind of thing, it's very challenging to convince people. That's what we do. You know, I think there's two parts of CEO. One is in front of his people, and one is in front of a mirror. And the one in front of a mirror is convincing yourself that you can keep a straight face, have high confidence, and can project, even though you have doubts. And, you know, we talked about, you know, my practice, what I do today. A part of what I do is talk to CEOs about how comfortable are they with unknowns and challenges in front of them? And can they be convincing that they can manage it as such? So I think that's a piece of advice I got a while back from a couple of board directors. Basically said, hey, Bob, don't show your insecurity in your grandiose scheme. You know, it's very important, but we understand you do have it.
I was just reminded of a quote around this whole being comfortable, being uncomfortable, and casting a vision that's bold, but it kind of frames pessimism versus optimism, right? Pessimism often sounds smart because optimism requires belief in the unknown.
Yeah, well, you just said it beautifully. Nobody wants to follow a pessimistic leader. They want a chance at success. They want to feel that the company is moving, not still, that it's evolving. And then they need to be felt comfortable that there's a place for them, because it all comes back to me in a people organization. You know, this is why power structures are so threatened by change, because it affects me. Who reports to me? Do I get credit for it? Does it affect my salary? Am I threatened by it? And so one of the problems and the challenges we face is what I call frictionless agility, where we're trying to make decisions not so painful for people and organizations to get used to being uncertain rather than challenging every uncertainty as such. So I actually think that, you know, early on you talked about what I think about a CEO today. I look at it and I go, boy, with the changes as fast as they are, with melding of sectors together, you know, it's really challenging to basically feel that what you can declare in your Wall Street Journal article is doable. I mean, Boone Pickens once said, being 15 years early is the same as being wrong in strategy. You know, so often I have felt I'm absolutely right. I'm just before my time, you know.
Right.
And
that's so it's back to the, you know, the self in the mirror, right? That you got to continue to convince yourself that, you know, just stick to it. It'll play out. Well, Bob, again, I just want to thank you so much for your time. And I have one more question before we wrap up to just build on what you just shared. It's regarding advice. And the question is, if you could go back and give your 30-year-old self a piece of advice, what would it be?
Yeah, it's very simply, don't be afraid to think bigger than people around you are thinking. Somebody has to take either the organization or the unit to another level that they all don't perceive. And if you're going to be a leader, you got to think bigger than the normal situation. And not be afraid of what I call failure. Failure comes, as one person said, from we didn't know what we didn't know when we found out and paid a dumb dividend. Okay. You can't be afraid of paying dumb dividends as long as they're not catastrophic. And it can't stop you from thinking bigger and wider than the company currently is. As such, I think one of the trends that we're going to find if is that we're going to see more cross-sector, cross-technology movement. In other words, if you're a strategist, I think you're sitting down and saying, okay, let's just say I'm in the, I don't know, I'll go back to my business, the water business. What's the transportation business doing now that could affect the water business? Is there a combination between transportation and water? How about the pharmaceutical business and the water business? How does that relate? You know, is there a connection or that? Should we have a pharmaceutical expert with us? And starting to move to cross-sector advantages and differentiation, I think is a noble approach to thinking bigger out of your sector.
That's a great piece of advice to end on, Bob. And every time you and I get a chance to sit down, I always walk away with about 10 more things that make me think and wonder about how I could incorporate this with our own business or even with some of our client organizations. So as always, I just can't thank you enough.
It's been fun, Scott, and I look forward to talking to you in the future.
Likewise.
As always, thank you for listening. Please join us next month for a conversation with Bob Murray, former president of Bond Brothers, Inc. And lastly, please remember to like or subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss an episode.